the secular world, Tor and Mada, kind of combining different worlds. And to finish off the day, three Brahmin here, will be reflecting on different areas that they kind of not in full shirim, just short thoughts about how our Torah and the secular world can combine. The idea is to get you thinking about not just the areas that we had. We don't need to go away. You just heard three shirim that were hopefully amazing. The idea is to get those shirim and the short presentation you're about to do now to think about the integration of these two worlds and how we can live that life as a modern Orthodox yeshiva in our own lives, in the communities that we're going back to. What does it mean for us as Jews in the modern world? We're going to talk about technology. We're going to be speaking a little bit about your own university studies. We're going to speak about science. So you're going to hear from these three, Ravim. And then after Zilsa, you're going to be thinking as well about your own questions. And we're going to do a slightly different format, which we'll tell you later. So I'm going to, I don't know which one of you wants to speak first, but...
we discussed it. You should speak first. We discussed it.
Okay.
Rob Gromit's
okay.
First.
I'll go first, but I'll probably be the shortest. One of the things that's been on my mind in this whole discussion, not just today, but I've been thinking about this stuff for a long time, and it's really the interface between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. Let me tell you what I mean. There are a number of areas where the spirit of the letter of the law requires us to do or forbids us to do certain kinds of things. And technology provides for all sorts of interesting ways around either the positive obligations or the negative prohibitions. And I can give you a couple of examples that point the direction to where technology is leading us. So, for example, if you want to talk about Hilchot Shabbat, so I'm sure that many of you are familiar with the concept of a grumma switch and all kinds of indirect actions or indirect actions. You can combine that with all sorts of other leniencies, kulot. For example, like there's very little halachic implication to voice. My action has halachic implication. Voice is not called a ma'aseh. Dibur is not considered a ma'aseh. So does that mean it's okay for me to ask Alexa to turn on my lights on Shabbat? Because I have not engaged in a ma'aseh. Well, dibur is not ma'aseh. So can I have Alexa control my house and do all sorts of things? Right? So there are a lot. That's one example of a whole string of things where, by the time you add up all the different things that are going on, the likelihood that you're actually being over any specific isur is really very, very, very small. And then when you consider all the kinds of benefits that could come as a result, And now the question is. So let's say we found halachic ways to get around all sorts of things, whether halachic ways to get around obligations that we have, isurim that we have. Some of you may have read about artificial meat, right? It's in its infancy now, but that stuff moves pretty quickly. In a couple of years from now, they might have parv artificial meat. Right now, it doesn't exist. Right, but it's not hard to imagine that a few years down the line, I'll have. Let me reframe that. High quality, parv, artificial meat, right? Because once you have it, the high quality is just a question of development, just a question of time. All right. What does that do to the entire area of basar b'chalav? Can we then imagine a world in which we, our kitchens, no longer have separate dishes, because we're going to commit to use only the artificial meat. We'll do that for environmental reasons and all sorts of other reasons. And then we're going to completely erase from the Jewish lexicon, except in theory, but erase the notion of basar b'chalav. So technology could, in theory, erase all sorts of categories of malachan shabbat, of basar b'chalav, of who knows what else. There are lots of different areas like this where we could find the technical solutions. And now, for me, the question is, when you have all these technical ways of doing these things, how does that now interface with the spirit of the law? Like, what's Shabbat supposed to be about? And how much does this spirit of the law, how much should the spirit of the law impact on what we imagine, what we design Shabbat to be like? How do you decide that spirit of the law? What role does technology play in that? To me, these are questions. They started about 100 years ago, a little bit more, 120, 130 years ago. But now they're becoming more... they're getting more and more in our face in all sorts of areas, whether you're talking about medicine, we're talking about Shabbat, we're talking about Kashrut. I want to talk about the things that are the core things in our lives, or in our Jewish lives, in terms of mitzvot. For me, that's a really important question. What's the implication of all of this stuff towards our understanding of the role that mitzvot are supposed to play in our lives? And are we moving towards a world in which all that stuff happens only in theory, but really very little in practice?
My choice.
Sure.
Okay, I'm supposed to speak. I'm the Saps guy. Ben Shapiro, the famous philosopher, quick-witted.
You speak really fast. From California, it's odd, no? But Ben Shapiro famously said that facts don't care about your feelings, right? And I think it went out around the internet everywhere. Well, I have a question. What if facts really do care about your feelings? What if there are times when facts are completely based on your feelings? So I'm going to give an example from the 19th century. Okay, the following is an article by Adam Gopnik in the New Yorker, where he's actually advocating for certain aspects of looking at science. But I want to talk about some of the problems of reliance on science, which became famous in the 1950s because of this person, Thomas Kuhn's famous book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. So this is the following. This is a similar pattern is apparent in the case of the search for Vulcan, you know, from Star Trek. Vulcan, I know it's Star Wars time, so everyone's like, you know, but you know, the Trekkies and the Star Wars people have a little war. Vulcan, the hypnotized planet that in the 19th century sat between Mercury and the Sun. Everyone knows about planet Vulcan, right? Between Mercury and the Sun, right? There's Pluto, we're not sure it's a planet. But Vulcan we know is a planet, right? I'm sure people have heard of planet Vulcan before. Not in Star Trek, right? So Vulcan, which stood between Mercury and the Sun, and explained perturbations in Mercury's orbit. So Mercury had some problems, and people couldn't understand why there were oddities in Mercury's orbit. As Thomas Levinson explains the hunt for Vulcan, 19th century astronomers were so in love with the idea of the missing planet, those feelings, right? They were so, had such feelings for that planet, that many of them, bewitched by random shadows, insisted they had seen it through their telescopes. In other words, we have scientists who, because they wanted to believe a planet existed, they saw the planet, they observed it, and recorded the observations. Only in 1950, when Einstein emerged with a new interpretation of the something to do with gravity and space-time curvature, could astronomers stop seeing what wasn't there? So, on the one hand, science comes along and produces these challenges to all kinds of ways we look at things. On the other hand, the question is, if you can turn things on its head, is science as pristine and perfect as a scientist would like to claim? There's an interesting article criticizing religion in a way by Dr. Rivka Press-Schwartz, if you know her, but I want to quote something. She's out of here where she's criticizing science. She's challenging the way we look at halakha from the way that people looked at science, claiming that Rabbi Soloveitchik compared halakha to science. Ergo, if we can attack science, ironically, then you can attack halakha as well. You can read the article, look at the article. But here's what she has to say about science. This really is in the wake of Thomas Kuhn's writings. She's quoting another person, Stephen Chafin, whose book I do not have. The book is called Never Pure Historical Studies of Science, and a very, very long subtitle. But he says the following. Chafin says scientists were embodied beings, meaning that they're human over time. People believe that facts are just facts. People saw Vulcan, it must exist, right? Had nothing to do with their feelings, Shapiro points out. Situated in a particular cultural context, but something has changed in much of the discourse of discussing scientists. Say, hey, let's take a step out and say, where are these scientists that are observing everything? So these scientists whose experiences shaped the work that they did, whose worldview shaped how they understood it, and whose often pettiness, national pride, agendas, and bureaucracy shaped how it was received by others. The response from many scientific practitioners obviously was very upset once people in the social sciences, and especially in the wake of Kuhn, started questioning them. What did Kuhn do? Kuhn came along and he said, listen, let's say that... how many of you guys have taken a science course in high school? Okay. Your teacher, where did they learn science? Anybody? Where did they learn science? Yeah?
A science course. Their science course in high
school. They took a science course. It's turtles all the way down. Right? So scientists took courses with other scientists who wrote books. And they were either reading the same books written by the same scientists, etc., backwards all the way forth. So that scientists were kind of stuck, and Kuhn came to this idea of paradigm shift, they're stuck in a paradigm, the way they view the world. And therefore, it's often hard, like these scientists who want to see Vulcan, believe they saw Vulcan, they record it in telescope, you know, based on telescopic observations on what they believe. The reason that's important to note, and some of the people say, well, yeah, but science has the advantage that it's... scientific articles are published in journals. Those journals we know have people who read them, and they're critical journals, and hence they'll always have readers, etc. There was a few fascinating observations. Someone did an analysis of 127 something like that of the most important papers in the medical field, including cancer research, et cetera, and try to replicate the results. And over 50% of the studies, the results weren't replicable. So these are major studies done in papers. Part of the problem is just scientists being a little open, and the good scientists really are, with the fact that science is more of a methodology than necessarily a fact. Science isn't like these facts just exist there, but rather it's a methodology of critical thinking. And I want to just, I was given this amorphous title of discussing like the being humble in science. I want to quote one lecture that was given at Caltech, at a commencement ceremony at Caltech, where the person speaking said the following. Said, the mistake then is to believe that the educational credentials you get today give you any special authority on truth. This is a big deal. This is like the issue. Often people say, oh my gosh, but science told me X, or I read Y, or I read Z. But the truth of the matter is that that's just not the case. What you've gained is far more important, an understanding of what real truth-seeking looks like. So it's the issue of the process as opposed to the facts. fact, someone produces something and says, well, this is the way things are. Rav Kook famously said, you know, scientists seem to change their minds not infrequently. That's a benefit of the scientific method, is that scientists will challenge themselves and say, hey, let's review this. But it also demands a certain amount of humility, because at any one point in time, you know, something could be reversed. Right, and therefore it might require a little bit of just thinking carefully when someone comes with a challenging idea from the scientific world and says, well, this is a fact, this is the way it has to be, when that's just, you know, not necessarily the case. We have too many examples throughout history where it's challenged. And that was kind of like my topic was supposed to discuss, humility within the scientific method. And I think I covered it. It's okay, so I covered my... That was my. I have a lot to say on it, but I have 10 minutes.
And you stuck to this, didn't
I? I did.
You know, every year we have this Yom Yod Torah U during Hanukkah. And every year, I have to say, the one thing I really love about it is you get different role models of people who've dedicated their lives, their careers, and their studies towards a topic. And then they apply it within Judaism. They apply it within the world of Torah and Halakha. I'm always blown away by that. They take everything, their expertise, and hand in hand, they take it with Torah. And to me, that's what modern Orthodoxy is really all about putting those two together. And the question that always kind of, I think begs itself is, so how do I choose my career? What role does Judaism have in the question of career, major? What am I going to dedicate my life to? Have we started to think about it? Some of us, we knew we were going to be whatever we were going to be when we were like 8 or 9. Some of us have no clue, and undecided is probably the majority major in the room. How do you choose your major, your career, from a Jewish lens? How do I come out like our speakers today did, where they were able to beautifully integrate their Judaism and their careers? How do I go about thinking about that? And the truth is, it's actually, it's a really big deal. Your career is your life. You will most probably perhaps a major part of your fundamental identity will be tied to your career. And the truth is actually an explicit Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi, for those of us that learned Kiddushin here, don't remember what years are represented, but if you remember the mission in Kiddushin, which talks about mitzvot ha'av al ha'ben, the mitzvot that parents are required to do for their children, one of them is to teach your child an umnut, right? To teach them a job. Yerushalmi has a quotes a braita, Tani Rabbi Yishmael, and says the Yerushalmi, ubacharta b'chayim. That sounds like an important pasuk. Remember where that's from? Bacharta b'chayim. Sounds like a good drasha. Choose life. Nitzavim. Kind of like God, Moshe giving a big speech. Choose the right thing. Choose life, not death. Good, not bad. Says Rabbi Yishmael, you know what it means? Choose the right occupation. Choose the right job. Because let's be honest, your life, your spiritual life, will be hand in hand with your career. Will be hand in hand with your career choice. And the question, therefore, is how do we choose the right career path? I have a feeling that most of the speakers that we heard today, had you asked them 20, 30, 40 years ago, what do you choose? How do you do it? Do you know you'll be one day giving this lecture at Eretz Tzvi? I bet you they have no idea. Because I have a feeling that, once upon a time, we probably, I don't know. How many of you grew up with your parents telling you, choose this career and not that career? Or like, this is a Jewish job, that's not a Jewish job? The truth is, there's actually a Mishnah. There's also, anyone, homework tonight. The last Mishnah of Kiddushin is Chazal telling you how to choose a job. Okay? All right, fine. The Mishnah has a machloket. It happens to be open in front of me. How do you like that? The Mishnah has three opinions, okay? The Mishnah is the third opinion is what we'll call the Haredi opinion. There's no better job than Torah. I.e., all jobs require interaction with the world, are dangerous, a good Jew should avoid. Not so helpful within the world of modern Orthodoxy. The first position of the Mishnah is choose carefully your job. There are some jobs that are like a little inappropriate. There's some jobs that are a bit too oriented towards, I don't know, have tzniut issues, have too many women issues, have too many temptations, have too many, you know, that particular job people tend to steal and cheat. Avoid them for its halachic moral issues. Okay? And the Gemara also, and the Mishnah gives you other options, and that is find a job that's convenient and suitable for your Jewish life. The Gemara meant, find a job where you don't have to work so hard and you can sit and learn for half the day. But how about when we think about a job as, is this job going to allow me to take off Friday? Will I be able to get home in time for Shabbat? Will I have no problem taking off Chagim? Will I have to worry about halachic issues and kashrut and Shabbat and you name it my entire career? That's a really good thing to think about. In the world today, I have a feeling, you know, we choose the career that we want, and then we say, wait, now, how does my Judaism fit in? The truth is that there are a lot more jobs today, I think, that are really very helpful. But I want to go one step, that can really fit with Judaism, we can talk about that. I want to go one step further. How do I make my job part of my Avodat Hashem? I'm not just interested in Jewish survival in your job. I want you to see your career as the next step of your Jewish development. I want you to be a better Jew because of your career. How does my Judaism express itself through my career? Okay, now it could be easy, right? Oh, I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to spend my life helping people. That's great. Rav Lichtenstein used to call that, Avodat HaKodesh, right? Because you're dedicating your life to helping people. What about for everyone else? How do I turn every job, every career, into Avodat HaKodesh? And I think that one of the things our speakers today modeled was, how do I look at Torah through the lens of my career and my expertise? And how do I look at my expertise through the lens of Torah? And to me, I think that's really the challenge for all of us. Modern orthodoxy means take whatever modern you are, take whatever mother you have, and I don't care what class you're sitting in, or what job you're part of. When an issue comes up, right? When can you imagine? Rav Ebner was sitting in English Lit class, and he read a poem. What was he thinking when he read the poem? Thought of a pasuk, tefillah, a mishnah. Today we see Rav Ebner, he looks at the mishnah, he sees a poem. But when he was learning, he saw Judaism through his mother. And all of us, no matter what we're doing, and it doesn't matter if it's programming, or math, or science, Judaism, Torah, is everywhere. Jump on the opportunity. Own it. Whatever your field is, ask, how does this relate to Torah around me? Learn the Masechet, learn the Sefer and Tanakh that relates to what you're learning about, and become an expert in it. Listen to 25 Shiurim. I don't know, you're involved in some enzyme, and it's got lots of kashrut issues. Yeah, go online. The OU is 35 shirim on that particular enzyme and its halachic issues, and now learn pieces of Yerodeah for it. There is no excuse why any of you will not come back in 25 years and be a speaker here today. Whatever your issue, not just the recharge guys coming back, there's no reason that whatever your career is, it could be law, it could be med, it could be computer, anything. Okay, you'll be the next Mobileye, or whatever the next big thing is. There's no reason you will not have empowered yourself through being here in yeshiva to learn, to make your career part of your Avodat Hashem.
Thank you very much. Okay, what we're going to do now...